For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hafa a day, ali'in, whakalawalai atu and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Egi Tupo, and coming up on today's show, how is Fiji's huge tourism industry coping with the country's drug problem? Well, maybe the setup of a well-resourced counter-narcotics bureau could be a good start to reduce the supply of illicit drugs. And there's fresh concerns about corruption and declining trust in government institutions in PNG. All those stories and more, and also giving acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, I say tagiatumas. Thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, last week, one of America's largest newspapers published a story on a Pacific, or paradise rather, island in the Pacific, meth and HIV epidemics rage. The Washington Post took readers to the streets of Fiji's capital, Suva, detailing the impacts of the country's growing methamphetamine problem, drug deals, sex work and HIV testing. None of it is new to anyone who follows local or regional news, but for international readers, it's painted a picture at odds with the image Fiji sells to tourists, a place where happiness comes naturally. So what impact could Fiji's drug problem and media coverage of it have for Fiji's hugely important tourism industry? Joining Pacific Beat to discuss this further is Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Tourism, Viriamit Gavoka. With that, I say good morning, Minister, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for giving me this time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Minister, as you've just heard, recent global media coverage on Fiji seems to be focused on the country's issues with illicit drug use and HIV. Are you concerned that this could impact tourism there?
Yeah, look, we take any coverage seriously, you know, because behind the headlines are real Fijians and the real public health and security challenges that we are addressing head on. We acknowledge, like many other countries globally, that we face social and public health challenges that require sustained attention and responsible leadership. These matters are being addressed through whole of government and community-based approaches in collaboration with regional and international partners. From a tourism perspective, we have not seen indications that this coverage has negatively affected visitor confidence or travel behavior. Tourism decisions are largely shaped by traveler experience, official advisories, and the safety and quality of service on the ground, all of which remain strong in Fiji. Tourism, as you know, is an externally vulnerable sector. So we take seriously any issue that could undermine our people or our reputation. At the same time, it is important to maintain perspective and not conflate broader and national conversations with the real experience of visitors of Fiji.
And so, Minister, with that perspective you speak about, looking from a US tourist market, they're a major source for Fiji's tourism. Is that the case?
Yes. The U.S. is a high-value and growing market for Fiji. In 2025, we welcomed close to 120,000 Americans into Fiji. That's about 12% of our total arrivals. 10 years ago, the figure was around 69,000-70,000, which reflects the sustained growth and increasing confidence in Fiji as a long-haul destination. Of course, as you know, Australia and New Zealand remain our largest source markets. But North America is a key pillar of our tourism diversification strategy, offering longer stays, higher average spend, and strong repeat visitation. The growth is being supported by improved connectivity through Fiji Airways and the American routes, as well as strong ongoing engagement with the U.S. travel trade and media. As you know, Fiji Airways, one SL airline, flies to Dallas, San Francisco, California, and Honolulu, bringing the many Americans to Fiji every year.
Yeah, and this is the case, though, when we think about numbers, Minister, and you would have heard in the title one story from the Washington Post saying, on a paradise island in the Pacific, you've got meth and HIV epidemics rage. Again, do you expect this to impact numbers from the United States?
Yes, we are aware of the article, and we understand why it draws attention. Our approach in a situation like that is to respond with facts, action, and transparency. Overall, visitors remain strong, arrivals remain strong, and we continue to monitor market segments closely. On HIV, government has activated a structural national response, including an HIV surge strategy 2024-2027, and an outbreak response plan to accelerate prevention, testing, treatment, and community outreach. On illicit drugs, we are intensifying enforcement and cross-agency coordination to disrupt supply chains and target organized crime. This includes nationwide consultation on a new counter-narcotics laws and an establishment of an independent counter-narcotics bureau, as we highlighted initially this morning. Importantly, international travelers, particularly from the U.S., tend to rely on official travel guidance, airline advice, and trusted travel providers rather than individual media stories. Fiji currently faces no travel restrictions or advisories that do discourage visitation. Mm. It is also essential to distinguish between national public policy challenges and the visitor environment, which remains safe, well-regulated, and professionally managed. As you know, a lot of the big boys, the big brands in the hospitality industry are in Fiji. So altogether, we're talking about a very professionally managed tourism industry here in the country.
Minister, I want to switch to, because obviously there's a lot going around in regards to the drug issue in Fiji, but what about when we look at HIV infections? Is the government doing anything to reduce this?
Oh, the effort is relentless. It is, you know, it occupies a cross-section of every ministry in this country. We are determined to come, you know, to eradicate this from our midst. You should see the coverage, even the coverage locally. We're not hiding from this. You know, we're not burying our heads in the sand. Mm. It's there. It's for us as a country that runs on democratic principles to overcome this threat to Fiji. We are committed to it. But as I said, you know, the dialogue on national policies should not conflate with the real experience of tourism on the ground here in Fiji.
And I'm sure many of those who would be listening in, I think, very simply would ask, is Fiji safe to travel to?
Yes. Fiji remains a safe and welcoming destination for travelers. Like any country, we advise visitors to take normal precautions, and we work closely across police, immigration, ports, aviation, health authorities, and the tourism industry to ensure visitor safety. Fiji tourism areas are supported by experienced operators, established safety protocols, and a strong interagency coordination. Visitor safety and well-being are treated as a priority across the sector. Notably, the U.S. State Department travel advisory for Fiji is level 1, and that's the safest. Mm. Exercise normal precautions, which reflects the overall risk picture. Our commitment is safety is about protecting both visitors and our people.
And Minister, as we wrap up, I understand, what would then be your personal message, you know, that you would like to share with tourists reconsidering travel to Fiji over these sort of news reports?
My message is simple. Fiji is open, Fiji is safe, and Fiji cares. We're not dismissing the challenges, we are confronting them. On HIV, Fiji has activated national plans to expand prevention, testing, treatment, and reduce stigma so people seek care early. On drugs, we are strengthening enforcement, legislation, and coordination. For visitors, your trip will be in well-managed tourism environments, supported by professional operators and strong public service. As always, we encourage travelers to follow standard travel and health advice, just as you would do when visiting any destination. We invite visitors to come to Fiji, to come, enjoy Fiji responsibly, and be part of a tourism sector that supports communities, livelihoods, and sustainable development across our islands. Let me close with this. Fiji is a nation that addresses challenges responsibly while remaining focused on what we do best, welcoming the world with warmth, professionalism, and care.
Thank you for that, Minister. Look, before I let you go, I know that, you know, the whole situation in regards to media and the influence that we have. And I just want to go back a little bit, though, if you don't mind, before I let you go. I know you were saying that media coverage of drugs, are you saying media coverage of drugs crime in Fiji is inaccurate when you mentioned the media coverage?
I've had issues with the media here. I've expressed my opinion that there's so much that is happening in the country that is beautiful, that is positive. But I know we understand how the way things work in the media. I just feel that the attention to this is a bit it's not balanced. But you know, not complaining. We live in a democracy. Freedom of the media and all that, which makes Fiji an attractive place to go to. That we are not hiding anything from anyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much again, Minister, for joining us this morning. I just want to say vinaka for your time.
Vinaka pagalebu. Mole manda naka.
And that is Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Tourism, Viliami Kavoka, here on Pacific Beat.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're still on the subject of Fiji's drug problem, and this week government officials, defence personnel, church leaders, community members and even United Nations representatives are gathering in Suva to discuss a proposed counter-narcotics bill. Among those to address the gathering was Amit Chan, a consultant with the Office of the National Security Assessments. He tells reporter Lucy Cooper setting up a well-resourced counter-narcotics bureau would be a good start to reduce the supply of illicit drugs.
I'm more focused on the reduction of supply, and that is the core issue that needs to be handled by the Counter-Narcotics Bureau and the law, because digressing from it, where I see a lot of consultations being held on reforms and rehabilitation, that is a secondary issue for me, where the faith-based organization, NGOs, are giving their positive contribution and the government is looking at it. But one of my focal point of address was the establishment of the Narcotics Bureau and how we are actively trying to address the issue of drugs in Fiji.
What do you think is fueling the drug crisis in Fiji?
It has been a long-standing issue that has been allowed to grow because of certain laxity of system. And right now, when tons of drugs are being caught, especially that is equivalent to our budget announcement's value. And as you know, when these kind of drugs are being offloaded into the country, of course, it is not meant for Fiji. It is meant for our as a safe haven, and then it's transited into Australia or New Zealand, wherever they want to go. But then it also filters into our country and our youths. So it is a very dynamic issue right now. There's a lot of focal points that needs to be addressed.
What is the biggest threat to Fiji's counter-drug efforts?
It is the operational failures. When I say operational failures, it means we have cartels paying off, let's say, strategic assets that they have recruited. And that is the biggest failure of our security system. If you look back last year, the head of customs intelligence was caught at our international airport trying to offload a drug package. Then people would say that that is again also in terms of him being caught. But that does not actually filter well if you look at intelligence side of things, because we have external partners that are giving us inputs that leads to a lot of seizures. But then there are other issues that needs to be addressed, because everybody who has been giving us those inputs, they have their own vested interests. But Fiji needs to have its own when we build the unit like CNB. That's what I said, we need to reset and focus on the integrity part at the inception phase, and then look at officers that are being deployed so that we can address those threats.
So from your perspective, corruption within the forces that are supposed to hold drug cartels and drug traffickers responsible is the key issue facing Fiji at the moment in terms of its anti-narcotics program?
Yes, of course, because this is what the drug cartels first targeted. They found the loopholes in the system. Plenty of money went around, probably, and that's why they gained to operate with impunity within our systems, because we also have a lot of loopholes in our EEZ, such a vast, small country with vast oceans and a lot of yachts coming in and out. Now, a narco sub's been spotted. And so those kind of complicated operations add another factor that the small country, small forces try to fight against. And it's not helping that certain individuals who are corrupt would give away precise intelligence that would help the syndicates. So, of course, that is where our major focus should be right now.
And that there is National Security Consultant Amit Chan from Fiji's Office of National Security Assessments speaking to Lucy Cooper. Now, the Solomon Islands opposition leader is questioning the Prime Minister's decision to sack two cabinet ministers who represent minority communities. MP for Rennell and Bellona, John Tuhaika Jr. and Polycarp Paya from Malaita Outer Islands were dropped in a cabinet reshuffle aimed at securing Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele's coalition government. Opposition leader Matthew Wale says it's disappointing that MPs representing Polynesian communities are no longer in cabinet. Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele spoke to journalists after his new ministers were sworn in at Government House.
Basically, to reflect a fair and balanced representation in the distribution of cabinet affairs within the coalition area, within the parties.
Prime Minister Christian Retaliong for the ABC. There are discussions that suggest that there are external forces that have influenced this reshuffling. What do you say to that?
Absolutely nothing. There are no external forces. It's basically a cabinet realignment to reflect our commitment to the full implementation of the government budget. And as I've said, to ensure that there is a fair and balanced representation in the cabinet among the two main parties.
Prime Minister Lisa from Tavoli News, with these changes, how stable is your government? Did you assure the people?
Government is very stable. Stability is demonstrated every day in Parliament, on the floor of Parliament. But on this occasion, let me also take the opportunity to sincerely thank the two ministers that have been relieved. They continue to be members of the cabinet, COPUS. So they will continue to contribute in policy making. I even intend, and I've been talking with them already, to appoint them as chair of a number of cabinet subcommittees.
Prime Minister, with speculation of more changes come, should the country prepare for more shake-ups or changes in key ministries?
Not at this particular stage. But as I've said, the changes that we have made were done after consultations with party queen leaders on the number of MPs within government. And I guess it shows our commitment in terms of implementing government policy and priorities. My interest is the national interest, that the government continues to deliver on goods and services for our people of Kowakan.
And that there is Solomon's Prime Minister Jeremiah Manila speaking to journalists. Now, his new lineup of ministers include Roland Seleso as the Provincial Government Minister, with Stephen Kumi as the new Traditional Governance Peace Minister, and Wayne Gemmell as the new Environment Minister. Pacific Beat. Well, Papua New Guinea is heading towards a national election next year, and there are warnings the integrity of the vote could be at risk. The latest Corruption Perceptions Index saw PNG's score drop to 26 out of 100, and raising fresh concerns about corruption and declining trust in government institutions. So, what does this mean for the Pacific's largest country, with a crucial election just around the corner? Joining us this morning is the Chief Executive Officer of Transparency International, PNG, Ariane Kasman. With that, I say good morning, Ariane, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Aggie. Thank you for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Well, Ariane, PNG's score, as you would have known, has dropped again in the latest Corruption Perceptions Index. How concerning is this result?
Yeah, look, it's unfortunate that this year we have dropped 4 points. And what we are unfortunately seeing is an observed pattern since 2012. When scoring started for Papua New Guinea of the CPI cycle. So improvements are made, and then we seem to be dropping during election year every 5 years. So it is a concerning trend for PNG. This for the 2025 CPI, what we did see is that PNG had an additional source. So 6 of the 13 sources were used to calculate the Corruption Perceptions Index score for Papua New Guinea. But again, just extremely concerning as we are only 17 months away from the 2027 national general elections.
Yeah, and as you say, it's sort of been dropping since 2012. I mean, but when we look at it now in 2026, in practical terms, what does that score tell us about just corruption itself in PNG right now?
Look, while there are efforts to try to look at addressing corruption, our biggest challenge is really look at the enforcement of existing laws, enforcement of, right across our land. And it's not just looking at the space of elections. It's also concerning when we look at the upcoming FATF grey listing as well. So I think for Papua New Guinea, it is really time for government to be serious about how we protect our integrity institutions and make sure that they are strong enough to fight or address corruption here in the country.
And I know you mentioned a little bit in regards to, it seems to maybe just dip when it's sort of heading into a national election year. But is there anything you can really say, particularly, what is it risky for public institutions during this period?
Look, I think it's always difficult. What we're seeing overall globally for the CPI, there is an observed trend that democracies tend to have less corruption. Strong democracies tend to have less corruption and vice versa. Democracy is weaker in countries with more corruption. And so the risks there for us are that, if we don't take action, if we're not enforcing laws, if we're not ensuring that people are held to account and that people are prosecuted for acts of corruption, we are going to see a continued deterioration of our CPI score.
Ariane, when we talk about transparency, they had actually warned similar issues emerged during the last election. So then what impact did that have on the integrity of the vote?
I think for the 2022 elections, there was a lot of discussion around what needed to be done, but not enough action was taken. Then we saw the 2022 elections happen, and unfortunately, again, by far one of the worst elections we have seen for the country. And so there was an immediate action taken by government to put in place a parliamentary committee, look at how we could address some of the reforms that needed to be put forward. Unfortunately, that parliamentary committee, when they had submitted their report to parliament, had not gotten their report adopted. And so no reforms had been taken up. And so we're stuck in a situation where potentially there could be rushed reform before the elections, which again just poses greater risks for a country like ours. And so focus really needs to be on making sure that the electoral roll is updated in preparation for 2027 national general elections, making sure that the Electoral Commission is properly funded and supported to be able to carry out the pre-election preparation, and just making sure that especially law enforcement agencies, those that are needed to work together to address the election preparedness, are also effectively nationally coordinating together, and also budgetary support is provided for them as well. So there are steps that we can take to actually help to improve the integrity of our elections, but the work actually has to start now.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is there still time for the government and authorities to act, and what concrete steps needs to happen right before polling day?
Yeah, look, there is time. First of all, making sure that there is a permanent appointment of the electoral commissioner so that the work can really take place. So make sure it's implemented. The plan of the PNG Electoral Commission is implemented this year. Secondly, would be making sure they fund the role update and making sure that it's transparent. So Electoral Commission will have to make sure that it's displayed as per the law and that people are able to update the electoral roll, check their names if they've moved. And then third, it's really looking at national coordination. There is a body called the Interdepartmental Elections Committee that's chaired by the Chief Secretary. They've already started their regular meetings. So just making sure that everyone that's supposed to be at that meeting is participating and is making sure that they are providing regular updates to strengthen our election preparedness. And then lastly, more importantly, like anything else, there is funding that is required. So annual budgetary support must be given to Electoral Commission agencies involved in election preparedness, including our law enforcement agencies such as the Police, Defence Force and the Correctional Service.
Nice. Thank you for that. Irene, I just want to switch to the actual, you know, CPI, the Corruption Perceptions Index. How is that actually, if you don't mind briefly telling us, how does it actually calculate it?
The Corruption Perceptions Index is a composite index, so it combines a number of surveys and assessments of corruption that's collected by a number of reputable institutions. So for the 2025 Corruption Perceptions Index, there were about 13 sources that were used to calculate this score or composite index. The CPI scores and ranks countries and territories based on how corrupt their public sector is perceived to be. So a country score indicates that perceived level of public sector corruption, where zero means that a country is perceived as highly corrupt, and 100 means that a country is perceived as very clean. So this year, there were about 182 countries and territories that appeared on the Corruption Perceptions Index, and they were all ranked according to their perceived level of public sector corruption.
And your taking, how reliable is it, though?
Look, it is a perception survey. It's important for all of us to also understand that it is a perceived level of how corrupt a country's public sector is, but it is put together by experts and business executives. So these are people that go into countries and do business with with our country, but that are also experts in various fields. So, you know, while it is a perception, I think it's important for all of us to take note of how our countries are being assessed, not just for Papua New Guinea, but also for the Pacific, and what we can do actively as citizens, as civil society, even as private sector, to strengthen the work of this, addressing corruption, strengthen governance, strengthen integrity of our institutions, so that we are a better region for working with others in the globe.
And with that, though, Ariane, I understand, does the government actually really engage with these findings? And if not, do you know why?
For Papua New Guinea, they do. So yesterday, we were able to hear an address from the Chief Secretary and also the Electoral Commissioner. Look, our government for Papua New Guinea has always responded and reacted to the scores. There is work that has been done through the National Anti-Corruption Strategy Task Force. But again, this challenge of enforcement is something that we as a country are still trying to grapple with. And so really the focus, and I think that this is something that government has said they will prioritize, is really on trying to ensure that we look at our existing laws. We make sure that we strengthen the law enforcement agencies, but we also strengthen all our integrity institutions to be able to do what they're mandated to do. So this might be the Auditor General's office being able to do their annual audits, the Public Prosecutor's Office being able to do their work as well, and even the Ombudsman Commission being properly funded to be able to carry out its investigations as well.
Ariane, thank you so much for joining us this morning, really being able to sort of give us a bit of insight and breaking that down for us. But again, I just want to say thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Aggie, and thank you to all our listeners.
No worries. That is Chief Executive Officer of Transparency International PNG, Ariane Guzman.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
DJ Noise. Am I doing that right?
Can I hear your best? Another one. Give us a DJ Khaled.
All right.
DJ Khaled.
We're the best music. Another one.
Anyway, Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me taki ma'ata. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. While a village in the southwest of Tana Island in Vanuatu has revived a traditional ceremony that hasn't been practiced for more than 70 years, it involves the sharing of namambe, a local nut which villagers collect for 5 days. Community leader Dominique Knuckles says he hopes it will strengthen cultural identity and keep the tradition alive for future generations.
It's really good to revive some of our old custom ceremonies like this one. The last time our elders performed it was around 1950s. And the purpose or the kind of these ceremonies, long before the civilization, there was a brother system governed by our society called Nakamal or custom governance. And it's about exchanging goods and products with each other, particularly when there was no form of cash or money during those days. They're using this sort of exchange or barter system. It has to be with two supreme nakamals or tribes, and they would exchange what each other don't have in a traditional way by bringing it to the nakamal. Only that way everybody would share it equally despite differences or disputes.
Thank you. So can you talk a little bit about what are the processes or steps that the villagers have to take in order to achieve this custom exchange?
Once that is confirmed, the chiefs confirm, okay, we can do it, then we ask the receiving community if they are okay to receive what we are going to exchange with them. We decide with them. We talk about the custom roads, if all clear, then we start preparing it. If they don't want to receive it for some reasons, then we look at other area. It took us about 5 working days to prepare it. And we have specific people in the village where they are assigned specifically. And then other villages just join in. just join in to contribute like we normally do in a Melanesian way, where we contribute to share to people performing functions and activities. And then we put them together, separate the nuts, different types, separate them with different names for educational purposes for kids to know it. And then when it's ready, the other village, the receiving village, will come down with kafa and chicken. And if they have any food products to bring it, and then they can bring it and receive what we prepare for them.
So will the village that will be receiving the namambe, will they also be exchanging food to your village?
No, with the one we have now, because it's a seasonal fruit like namambe, they're not exchanging anything now. What we're doing is we're establishing a custom road for the future and bigger custom ceremonies like toke, etc., in case they decided to exchange taro in future. But we already established a connection. And it's also, this is also very important for the following reasons, like keeping the custom alive and passing on the knowledge to the next generation. And of course, distributing the seasonal product in a more transparent process so everyone has an equal say. Starting from a child to elders, including disabled people within the community.
So you mentioned that this ceremony was last practiced in the 1850s. Now that we're in this time and you're trying to revive this type of ceremony, has there been anything changed, any in terms of, you know, the ideas around organizing this kind of exchange?
Yes, the civilization has changed a lot, especially cash crops. When people see there's enough products or fruit trees or nuts, what they normally think of is turning it into cash. That's what has changed a lot. And I guess the lifestyle nowadays, with a lot of things that you need to pay for, like school fees, hospitals, that has ended a process of traditional bartering or trading system. People see it now for making it, like turning it into cash. I really want to encourage the young generation not to forget the traditional ways of doing things, because it normally brings us peace in the village where there's no disputes, everyone join in, and of course learn the different ways of how we do things in a more different cultural way.
And that there is Dominic Naka from Tana Island in Vanuatu, and he was speaking to Leah Lowenbu.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Cases of cancer is surging across the Asia-Pacific, but a new Australian-led study reveals many national health systems still don't know who they're treating, what's working, or who's being left behind. The study is the first regional benchmark of cancer data systems across 16 Asia-Pacific countries. It found that more than half of the cancer treatment centres in lower-income countries still rely on paper records. Lead author from the Institute for, apologies, for the George Institute for Global Health, Dr. Viknasari Batumalai, tells reporter Lucy Cooper the story is even worse in Pacific Island countries.
Our study is the first to benchmark oncology data systems across the Asia Pacific. And our findings are really clear. There are significant disparities in how patient information is captured and used. And without reliable data, health systems cannot effectively monitor outcomes, plan services, or even identify who may be missing out on care. But encouragingly, many centres already have strong foundations, meaning targeted investment and training could rapidly strengthen cancer care across the region.
And why is this significant?
So data equals patient care. So good data is not just record keeping, it's essential for safe, equitable cancer care. We can't improve cancer care if we can't see what's happening.
The study interviewed professionals in countries such as India, Indonesia, Cambodia, Malaysia, and Mongolia, but no Pacific country was included. Why is that?
Okay, so to answer that, we just have to go back to the basic. So the Pacific, while they are making important progress in cancer prevention, especially cervical screening and HPV vaccination, for example, but treatment capacity also must grow in parallel. Radiotherapy is the third pillar of modern cancer treatment besides surgery and chemotherapy. But there are only one operating radiotherapy centers in the Pacific Island. So for that reason, they were not involved in the initial part of the study. But what we did as part of the study, or as part of this whole initiative to improve the cancer data, is we held a workshop here in Sydney last year and invited participants or clinicians from all these countries. But we also invited clinicians from PNG and Fiji to come and contribute to the discussion. And that really gave us some insights into how we can further contribute to strengthen the cancer services in this region.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, there's currently only one functioning radiotherapy department in the entire Pacific. There's an older cobalt machine in Lae in PNG. I know that there are plans underway for a new centre in PNG and also a department in Fiji, but progress has been slow. Does this really indicate that before the Pacific even looks to, say, updating their records when it comes to cancer and health systems, they actually need the services first?
Yeah, that's correct. It's the basic thing is to actually have the service. So, you know, without treatment, many patients won't have access to this life-saving treatment. So that's why, as you mentioned, Australian clinicians, including the senior author in this study, Associate Professor Mei-Ling Yap, are already contributing to specialist training in the Pacific, and that includes developing the services as well as information on data capture and the importance of it. So really, the continued partnerships and investment is really necessary to ensure the treatment capacity keeps pace with growing cancer needs in the region.
Would you be keen to commence a similar study looking at these gaps in a place like the Pacific?
It won't be similar because, as I said, they don't even have radiotherapy services, so there's no data available. But as we're developing these services, it's a long way away to get this data.
And that there is Dr. Vignesvari Muttumalai, Senior Research Fellow at the George Institute for Global Health. Up next, it's your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
That's right, we head around the region right now to get the latest headlines brought to you by our producer, Finol Fonoi, in the studio with me. Good morning, Sue. How you doing?
I'm good. Good morning, Aggie.
All right. What are we? It's Wednesday today, right? Okay. Vanuatu is pushing a new UN resolution demanding full climate compensation. What does this mean?
Yes. Well, according to reports, Vanuatu wants the UN General Assembly to enforce last year's landmark court decision to require states to have a more climate responsibility, basically. So this draft is calling on a UN resolution to require countries responsible for climate change that they be required to pay full and prompt reparations to countries that are developing countries that are affected that have suffered a climate crisis due to fossil fuel emissions. Vanuatu wants a legally binding obligation to prevent climate harm and requiring compensation if these obligations are not fulfilled.
Right. Okay, then. All right. Thank you for that one, Finol. We head to Papua New Guinea, though, because their government has appointed an Australian as the new commander of Enga Province. Tell us more.
According to the National agency, news agency, Australian police officer, Chief Superintendent Stephen Harris, is the top police commander in Angang province. David Manning, the Commissioner of Police for PNG, has spoken very highly of Mr. Harris. He said yesterday that Harris brings decades of experience in policing, and his appointment will help strengthen discipline and professionalism within PNG's law enforcement. It's a challenging task for anyone to run to be the top commander in Angang province. Yeah. Angang province has had a lot of problems, as you know.
Yes.
Tribal warfare, probably the biggest.
The landslide too.
And yes, yeah. A lot of work to be done.
Okay, well, thank you for that update. We head to Tonga now. I believe the Ministry of Health there has put the village of Hofoa under restrictions for 60 days due to typhoid cases. Wow, what's happening here?
Yes, the restrictions are simply preparing and sharing, prohibiting the preparation and sharing of food in the village. There's been 3 confirmed cases in the village of Hofoa, which is located just out of Nuku'alofa.
Yes.
Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ofa Tukia said that transmission is localized, and there's been 43 contacts, and they just want to contain the spread of typhoid.
Yeah.
Don't want it to go beyond Hofoa.
That, well, absolutely, which is, I suppose, a really good thing to do. And I believe that, you know, not I believe, I know, because we're Tongans, the sharing of food is really common, right, amongst us, and in Tonga as well as other parts of Pacific Islands. I mean, do we know how many residents in Hofoa?
254, and you're right. Sharing of food, we love doing it.
Anything, a little bit of buaka and pig and taro? Absolutely, I'd like to share that. But 254, is that the only... Is it the amount of people in there?
Just 254.
Wow. Okay, yeah. And so the fact that there is 43 contacts across the 4 blocks, I understand why there needs to be a bit of containment, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 1/5 of the population.
Wow. There. All right. Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Finau. Appreciate it, as always, when you come through with the headlines here on Pacific Beat. All right, to sport now. The NRL has officially launched its 2026 season, with the captains of each team displayed at a presser on yesterday at Sydney Harbour. 4 of the captains are of Pacific Islander heritage, including Titans captain Tino Fa'asua Maleawi, who resumed his captaincy for a 5th year running.
It's awesome to see, to, you know, have such good leaders like Jerome and Crichton at our Samoan. To show our, you know, our Polynesian people that, you know, they're leaders within themselves and their community, and obviously in whatever space they work in, that they can be leaders and lead for the front for their people. So it's a real proud moment, and it's excited.
Now, this year's NRL season will be significant as it precedes the Rugby League World Cup, expected to host exciting games. North Queensland Cowboys second row Jeremiah Nanai, who represented Samoa for the first time last year, said his debut for his motherland was the highlight of his career so far.
Playing against Tonga, that was my first time ever, and you know, that was probably the best crowd of best experience I've ever had.
One of the standout players of the NRL in recent years has been Bulldogs captain Stephen Crichton. Now, the Bulldogs fell short of reaching the grand final last year. Crichton, who was a member of the Penrith Panthers team that won the NRL Premiership in 2022, says the highlight of his career was his NRL debut and representing Samoa on the international stage.
Hard work pays off, and when you play your first NRL game, you're never going to forget that. And then other than that, just playing Samoa, that's been a massive one for me, especially being born overseas there and coming here. And yeah, it's never a no for me to play for Samoa.
And that was Canterbury Bulldogs captain and tall Samoa centre Stephen Crichton here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Please join us tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, I'm your host, Aggie DeBoer, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.